This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
No! It's a camouflage!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
No one knew how they spawned so fast. They swarmed like locusts. Burning everything in their path, driven by one purpose, to feed. Even then, we couldn't believe they were real. Ancient man had made them into myths. But nature had made something far more terrible.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia. Nice to have all of you guys back. So we had a little bit of a scheduling conflict with the episode that we were hoping to bring you guys this week. Basically revolving around Annihilation, the Natalie Portman film that I think universally we all loved. We'll hopefully be bringing that to you guys either next week or a week after. In the meantime, we've got a little sort of filler episode that we thought we would bring you guys. And this one is roughly titled Puff, I Made a Dragon. So I'm joined, as always, by Adam Hasek, or Dr. Adam Hasek.
Thank you, Dr. Dave.
And Baroness Libby. Sam will not be joining us this week for his own scheduling conflicts of, I don't know.
It's one of those things where when the sun goes down in Norway, the trolls rampage through the countryside. And as we all know, Sam is, if not more, than quarter troll. So he gets a little squirrely, to say the least.
But he's the only Dr. Troll, so he's on high demand.
He is Dr. Troll.
And if he's going to choose between rampaging or being rampaged at, I mean, I feel like he's making the right decision.
Yeah. I think so.
In the meantime, today we are going to be having a little bit of fun with basically seeing whether or not I can design a plausible dragon, something that Adam will back me up from the ecology side, and I'm hoping Libby will not absolutely tear down from any form of story format. But I don't think any of the creatures that I've generated are going to be particularly terrifying.
Cracks neck, cracks knuckles.
Oh no, my poor creatures.
I think you'll be fine. It's one of those things where a little bit of backstory for those of you who haven't heard previous episodes, where we've broken down the Game of Thrones dragons, which I think are technically wyverns because their front limbs are wings and they're not wings on their back. They're not quadrupeds. And then How to Train Your Dragon dragons. We've broken down a few of those. And Toothless is a dragon. But those we know from having a quick think about it in general, but also from those episodes, dragons don't really work physiologically or ecologically in the real world. So Dave is going to do his best to make that work.
Also, for those of you who say wyverns normally, that's totally acceptable.
Wyvern is the correct pronunciation.
I'm more with Libby on this front, but we'll move on. Mm-hmm.
So you're both wrong.
Before we start, as always, Adam, do you want to give our pluggables?
Absolutely. I think that, yeah, we don't really have too much as far as news goes this week beyond the schedule.
You can talk
conflict.
About your tiger thing.
Yes.
Dragon of Houston.
Yes, the Dragon of Houston. I don't know if you saw this, Dave, but Texas, which is a rather unfortunate part of the United States, is known for the exotic animal trade.
Sorry, Texas.
And there are a ton of tigers, lions, and other non-native animals being housed by private owners in the state of Texas. And today, might have been yesterday, but this week at least, a adult tiger was seen walking the streets of a residential neighborhood in Houston.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure what happened to it. I hope things went well, but the video I saw was being filmed by a panicked individual trying to hide behind their house as this tiger was approaching somebody on the street who was not doing their best to move away, so not sure what happened with that.
Man, I'm surprised with all the open carry that there just wasn't a fucking tiger gunfight going on.
My understanding listening to the message this morning is it has escaped from one of those sort of Tiger King style sanctuaries and apparently had escaped.
Sanctuary.
Yes.
And in quotations, if you couldn't hear it in our voices.
Apparently had escaped a couple of days ago that the keepers had realized the tiger was gone and they didn't let anyone know because they did not want to trigger a public panic.
Ah,
oh, good.
Classic.
Yeah. The same response as to any time the U.S. military has lost a nuclear weapon, and they've been like, they're probably fine.
Shh, don't worry about it.
On happier news, and like a happier kind of story about that of not wanting people to panic, back in the Arkansas, the state where Libby and I live, is known as the Bear State. At least it used to be known. We're now technically the natural state. But that's because there was an enormous population of black bears here in this part of the country, and they were hunted to extinction, unfortunately, until the 1970s, where some members of the Game and Fish Department of the government body decided to just go up to Wisconsin or Minnesota and grab a couple bears and just bring them down without really telling anybody and just let them go. So they did that. A couple years go by, and people start calling in, like, there was a bear in my backyard. And police are like, no, there wasn't. Like, no, there was a bear. And the reports just keep coming in. Mm-hmm. They keep stacking up until they're like, Game and Fish eventually came out like, okay, yeah, we brought the bears back 10 years ago. That was us. We'll cop to that one. So now there's bears again in Arkansas.
Yeah. I've only ever seen one, but it was dead on the side of the road. So.
I've never seen one.
That wasn't happy.
But the bears are back, and that's happy news. But as far as where you can find us, you can find Sam in absentia at Big Dr. Fishboy on Twitter. You can find me at Hassick Adam. You can follow us on for more of our hardcore ecological stuff at ecologyforthemasses.com. If you want to see some more of Libby's work, you can see shortstorysoup.substack.com. If you want to contact us at the podcast, email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. Or if you want to check out the website, it's cinematicaanimalia.com. Take it away, Dave.
Let's go already!
So, this week, we'll be playing around with the concept of a realistic dragon. I want to start with a brief overview of, we all know what dragons are, large-scale reptiles, or as Adam would call them, reptile birds, that basically exist in such a way that they breathe fire, usually with the goal of incinerating whatever they're eating. There's been a whole bunch of different takes of it. Rain of Fire played around with the idea that they basically burn the world so they can eat the ash, a concept that makes...
Which is so cool.
It makes no nutritional sense, but is super cool. We've talked about them before in a number of other films, but that's kind of their key thing. They fly, they breathe fire, and they often eat the things they set on fire.
And they're quite large, usually.
Mm-hmm. And they like gold.
They do like gold.
Gold!
Now, everyone always asks the question, and it's come up a lot in various biological discussions as well as internet discussions, what type of animal breathes fire? And the simple answer is nothing. Because...
Damn it, Dave!
Because it's fire, and fire is fucking terrifying. So, there are a couple of species that get close, the closest examples being those that resist extreme temperatures, some of which we've discussed before. There's various forms of bacteria that exist in extreme forms of heat. We call them thermophiles. There are...
Extremophiles.
And we've talked about the forms of tube worms that exist near thermal vents. So extreme heat sensitivity, definitely something that can occur. And we've talked about some species before that can generate extreme heat, like the pistol shrimp. We've also briefly talked on the Bombardier beetle, the species that can generate this sort of heated fluid that it expels from its back end in such a way to try and protect itself from attacking predators.
And for those of us who might have heard it pronounced differently, bombardier beetle. I'm not saying you're wrong, because you're probably right from a somewhat French-speaking part of the world, but... I've always heard it as bombardier, so just in case people knew by that name.
Frankly, bombardier sounds cooler. So
it's pretty cool.
We don't have any species that breathe fire. And the easiest explanation for it is it's not a usable mechanism. And as clever as Cinematica Animalia might be, we're not clever, more clever than millions of years of evolution.
I mean, we got three doctors and a baroness.
Yeah, we do. We do.
You sure?
Likely, if breathing fire made any form of sense, we would have seen it at an earlier point. There would be some species that would have some example.
There are a bunch of rappers that spit fire.
Ooh, yes.
It's the trendiest thing I've ever said.
Now,
or if you're a fan of the early 2010s internet culture, super hot fire.
Oh, God.
Now, I am going to try to create three different creatures, because I apparently couldn't settle on one, that will exist in their own ways of breathing fire, exist with their own mechanisms for breathing fire, and are most likely going to get torn to shred by an honest discussion from my colleagues today. But we'll sort of try to make it work.
That was me cracking my knuckles directly into the microphone.
Now, a couple of quick points to start with. One, you cannot, and I played around with biological mechanisms, have any situation in which you expel a continuous stream of fire. As cool as flamethrowers are, they have a whole bunch of metallic and straight up mechanized forms of controlling fire that just can't be generated in biological processes. There's no way.
When Dave says controlling fire, he says it in quotations because flamethrowers are incredibly dangerous.
Right. Perfect example. And nature, generally speaking, doesn't love to create things that could cause you to explode. Not a fantastic thing. So the species that I'm going to be focusing on today are going to have some atypical mechanisms, but it's also because there makes no sense to burn your prey with fire. It's not an effective mechanism. I mean, it's effective in that it will definitely kill them. And don't get me wrong, for everyone out there who wants to feed their dog raw, please stop. Fire is good. Cooking is good. Bacteria, bad. Salmonella, bad. But there really isn't a great mechanism for using it in an effective manner to cook prey that you're intending on eating. So that being said, I'm going to get into my three creatures.
So, when do I get it?
Get what, a hug? Let's find a planet with a garden hose first.
A dragon!
A dragon.
You asked me to cut class and fight robots with you. I said no. You said millions of lives depend on it. I said I'll do it for a dragon. You said whatever. I want my dragon.
You know who's into dragons, Morty? Nerds that refuse to admit they're Christian.
I want my dragon. I want my dragon. I want my dragon. I want...
So the first thing that I had to think about from a biological perspective was, why would something want to breathe fire? And sort of what environments would they want to live in? So the three different species that I've generated for this discussion, I'm going to title them, unless Libby can think of a cooler name, which I'm sure she will, the Arctic Fire Breather, the Desert Drake, and the Jungle Blazing Frog. So my Arctic Fire Breather, as the name would suggest, is going to exist in Arctic or freezing temperatures. My Desert Drake is going to exist in dry, sort of desert Saharan climate. And my Jungle Blazing Frog is probably going to find its home in the Amazon, where it's going to be fairly moist most of the time.
Now, Dave, first, I appreciate your usage of the word moist.
Thank you.
But I'm going to put you on blast a little bit here and ask that we refer to this as the Desert Drake because of your typo in the Google Doc.
Fuck. Well, I got to roll with it. Now, the Desert Drake. So
yes.
Moving to where my species or what they're going to use their fire for. Again, I don't see any species is using it to cook their enemies. So to start with my Arctic fire breather, I spent a lot of time looking at polar bears. And something I didn't realize was that polar bears are actually very limited before climate change started kicking their ass in terms of where they could hunt. And usually they had to find themselves on the edge of ice drifts, basically looking for seals or other material that they could sort of get access to through open water, or looking for areas of extremely thin ice that they could break through, dig through in order to move their way down and basically go after their prey. And that takes a lot of energy. There are big swaths of ice then as a result that you can't cross. And ice is fucking hard. As anyone who's ever been skating or done anything like that, it's a pain in the ass. You cannot dig through that. There's no good mechanism for breaking it apart. Unless you could in some way generate a flame or at least a flaming compound that would help you to weaken the integrity of the ice such that you could create your own holes, your own open spaces where basically you can ice fish wherever you want. So that's going to be the first mechanism for what I would see my Arctic fire breather using its ice for. The second is my Desert Drake in terms of what would it use it for. Now, desert species struggle a lot with finding each other. There's a lot of ground and space in between from area to area. And for populations to mix, they obviously have to be able to identify and find one another. Now, the way that I'm envisioning is if we had a reptilian species that needed to communicate over long distances to either A, attract a mate from a long distance, or two, create a mating display. The advantages of the hot temperature that's going to be involved in the sand is that it's going to be able to use the lack of moisture in the air as well as the ambient heat to generate fire much easier. And I'm wondering whether or not a species could use it in such a manner to basically attract or bring in a mate or even use it for kind of a peacock mating display. Kind of like the Lilo and Stitch situation where the loved character David accidentally sets himself on fire. Great name.
Absolutely.
And then the last sort of mechanism that I'm getting at is the Jungle Blazing Frog. The easiest way for what you would use fire for is for getting away. Octopus likes to basically squirt oil. There are various forms of reptile species that disengage their tail to get away. Trying to get away from predators that bite you or are currently very close to you is a very key mechanism of survival. So now we get to the hard part. How do you generate fire, which is fire?
And also, I think an important thing to put on there is, in what situation would this kind of behavior or adaptation be selected for?
Ooh.
It's important to think about these kind of adaptations where it's not an organism deciding like, oh, it'd be really handy if I could breathe fire to try to break through this ice. That'd be really handy. Or, oh, I don't know where any females are. Let me just belch up a gout of flame real quick and see if any of them come calling. It's not necessarily, that's a more design type argument. That's called Lamarckian evolution, which is not true. That's like saying that a giraffe saw the leaves really high in a tree. It was like, well, if my neck could just grow a bit longer, that would be great. And so their kids' necks grew longer, but that's just not how it works. You just happen to have mutations arise in a population that over time, if they're selected for, will start to increase in number. So if you have giraffes trying to eat plants that are higher up, if one of them has like a mutant baby that happens to have a slightly longer neck, it might have a bit of an advantage.
Right.
It then breeds more. Its kids most likely also have that neck, which is an important component of this. You not only have selection, but the mutation has to be heritable. It has to be passed on to your offspring. So we have to keep in mind of how this can happen with these three creatures, and then physiologically, how can that even work?
Also, the names that I've come up with so far are Snowpiercer,
okay,
Desert Dancer,
mm-hmm,
and the Hot Houdini.
Damn, my names like suck. All right, cool.
And please, the first one is Bong Joon-ho Snowpiercer.
Exactly.
This chaos. 1,000 people in an iron box. 18 years I've hated my train. 18 years I've waited for this moment.
So, I really want to round back to the ecology debate, because I feel like it's going to knock a lot of my mechanisms aside. But just getting them out of the way for my Snowpiercer or Arctic Fire Breather, there were sort of two different mechanisms that I kind of played with that I thought I could make this work. So the first was straight up stealing from the, how did you pronounce it? The Bombardier beetle? Bombardier?
Bombardier.
Bombardier beetle. That is cooler. So the Bombardier beetle's mechanism. Bombardier beetles have this really fascinating situation. They basically have these two big glands that are found in their abdomen, and they're able to mix two different compounds together. So a type of catalase or peroxidases that they basically secrete into this chamber. The makeup then triggers this situation where there is a decomposition of something called hydrogen peroxide. It creates this really energetic, or what we call exothermic reaction, that allows for the release of this fluid, where basically it boils to near 100 degrees. Approximately a fifth of it is vaporized, and then it shoots out the back of these beetles and generates this kind of boiling solution that they can use to escape. It's also apparently quite foul smelling.
Yes.
Now, they have this system where basically they've got an armored chamber that they kind of deploy this from, and they find themselves in a situation where they have valves that click in place that protect the fire from moving in the wrong direction, where basically it would cook their internal organs. Now, I'm envisioning that my Snowpiercer Arctic Fire Breather is going to be a mammal. I think it's going to be something akin to the polar bear in terms of adaptation, because it has to be generating its own form of heat up there. We don't get a huge amount
Absolutely.
Of, right. We don't get a lot of reptiles in the cold. So if it's up there, and I imagine it's going to be something as discussed, that's going to be looking to break this ice. Now, mechanism one is that it basically uses a situation like this, an organ that produces a boiling solution that it kind of spurts out onto the ice that helps to weaken and break it down. The biggest problem with that is, one, mammals aren't into insects, and creating a thick carapace organ on the inside is going to be difficult, as well as two, boiling solutions may seem absolutely awesome until they hit Arctic temperatures, at which point that little bit of boiling material just quickly cools and you really haven't done anything to the ice.
If you've seen those videos of the people throwing boiling water into the air when they're living in really cold places and just instantly vaporizes, this is what you can imagine happening to this poor Snowpiercer.
Or those videos trying to do that and then just throwing boiling water in their face.
Themselves.
Yeah, don't,
seen that too.
Don't do it.
Now, the second one, and the one that I'm more interested in, is the idea of using a reactive compound. So we briefly talked about reactive compounds previously on the podcast, but just to get back to them, we've talked previously about something called white phosphorus, which is a phosphorus compound that basically spontaneously bursts into flame when exposed to oxygen. It's the key component behind the phosphorus grenade, something we'll be talking about in the future Annihilation episode. Now, I always think of white phosphorus with a fond memory from when my biology professor was trying to show us what white phosphorus was, and he took out the stick of the material encased in oil and tried to take a small piece of it off to try and show us what would happen when the oil was removed, allowing it to get exposed to oxygen, which unfortunately led to him exposing the entire bar to oxygen, set his desk on fire, set off the fire extinguishers, and had to have a very serious conversation with the principal after that for his use of chemicals.
Holy shit. It is one
of the founding moments for what solidified my love of science. So,
yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that can happen. I'm in.
That's one of those things where you see, like, these chemical reactions are not a joke, and they can happen very quickly. Dave mentioned the term exothermic earlier, which is where you create a large amount of heat. And in a chemistry lab in college or university, I was supposed to be doing some experiment with calcium. And calcium, which on its own, reacts quite violently with water. So I had a test tube of water. I was supposed to put a little bit of calcium into this water. My dumbass dropped the entire chunk of calcium into this test tube, which literally started shaking in my hand. So I had to put it away very quickly and let this exothermic and, frankly, scary reaction take place away from my skin.
That does sound terrifying. Now, that does bring me to the second compound, which is something called calcium carbide. So calcium carbide actually has one of the most exothermic and nasty reactions when exposed to water, and particularly ice. And there's a couple of fantastic YouTube videos of people dropping this on, because amazingly, calcium carbide reacting with water produces acetylene gas that we'll know from acetylene torches. And the exothermic reaction can actually create a situation where the acetylene basically lights itself and you create a fire that can kind of burn through ice. Absolutely fascinating, very limited to a laboratory setting. No idea how this would work out in the real world. Now, what I'm envisioning is a species that's in a position where basically it has a gland that secretes these types of chemicals, whether or not it's a calcium carbide or a phosphorus or something that's going to either violently react with oxygen or more likely violently react when exposed to water. Now, you may be asking yourself, how does a creature that is composed of water make something that reacts violently with water? The easiest...
That's a good question, Dave. Mm-hmm. Please tell us.
The easiest explanation is the same mechanism by which we protect our stomach from hydrochloric acid that's being secreted. Basically, secreting the acid in front of glands that are secreting an inactive substance like mucus that we can use to repeatedly create to try and protect ourselves. Now, that being said, hydrochloric acid reacts with mucus in a super boring way. A compound that bursts into flames in your abdomen is probably not a great idea, but go nuts. What I'm envisioning is this creature basically producing an inert substance that it can wrap these types of chemicals out on, and basically finding itself where it can regurgitate or spit up these contents that it's producing from a gland up onto the ice, and then back the fuck away, where then the compound is going to start to react over some time, generate a flame that will at least damage the ice enough that the organism can break the rest of the way through, and then hunt whatever it wants to that's present under the ice.
This is something we could see. It would make sense, at least ecologically and potentially evolutionarily, for this to eventually build up over time.
Okay.
We have mechanisms like the bombardier beetle, where this is a very violent chemical reaction that is taking place, but there are safeguards in place to ensure that it can happen safely. And this inactive form of these chemicals, which is what I think that what you told us the bombardier beetle has, is reminding me of my own study system working with insects for my PhD, where their immune function involves this enzyme that is kept in its inactive state in their blood. And basically, once it's activated, it then starts this cascade, which produces melanin as its end product. And melanin then encases whatever is making you sick or a parasite trying to pierce your body, what have you, which will then kill it. The problem is melanin is a reactive oxygen species, which is bad for your body. So if you produce too much of it, it can start harming you. So if you have the Snowpiercer, then be able to have one chamber holding the inert compound, one chamber holding some enzymes that will then activate that compound. This could work potentially.
Cool. Yeah. So is basically spitting that material up. Now, the question that I have for our resident story specialist, I don't feel like I've created a great monster here. My question is from a movie context or perspective. Could we make this scary?
You know, I think you could make it, it's all about point of view, right? So you could do like a twisted, horrifying children's animated where like you're the seal or the penguin that the thing is trying to eat.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh.
Dark children's tale.
Ooh, the thing that's melting through the ice repeatedly. You keep trying to move away from it, sheltering mm-hmm. your family as this thing just gets yep. closer and closer to finding you. Okay, that would be scary as fuck.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I was trying to imagine Liam Neeson fist fighting this thing out in the Arctic, and it just really wasn't selling it for me.
Oh, I think it still works. If Liam Neeson and all of his dumb survivor buddies are trying to hole up in a bunker, and this creature is hungry and decides it's going to try to eat him, what's to stop it from spitting up its little calcium carbide compound on their base and just melting right the fuck through it?
Pack hunting species. That'd be kind of cool.
Ooh, or a lost Iditarod driver.
Ooh.
So they get like disoriented in the snow, separated from people.
Oh, I like that.
So a 1v1.
Yeah, okay, cool.
This is the plot of Balto 3. The Balto wing.
Exactly. All the dogs survive in my movie.
Don't worry, we're going to front load this preview for this fake movie with that. The dogs are fine.
Yes.
The driver?
Who knows? Who knows?
But the dogs are totally cool.
Sorry, and then the last point, actually, sorry, before I move on to the fire breather was, or the snow piercer, was the fact that the Arctic is going to act as a natural protectant mechanism, hence why I'm imagining this species at low temperature. You're a lot less likely to get burned by your own fire in a situation where you're protected by at least cold to a certain degree.
Interesting.
Well, do you not get angry?
I'm not angry.
You look angry. And bothered, look at you, you're downright flush.
Yes, that is what happens.
When one is angry.
When one burns for someone who does not feel the same.
If you would have only looked at me this week for longer than 2 seconds, you would have seen. It is you I cannot sacrifice. I burn for you.
Now, the second species getting into. So what did you rename my desert drake, Libby?
The desert dancer. So I imagine he doesn't shoot a flame. He does like a little, you know, I'm thinking like jumping spider.
Yeah.
Peacock spider. Little dance with it.
I'm kind of hoping for that. So for the desert drake or the desert dancer, this mechanism I'm playing with slightly differently. So I'm imagining a small reptile. Something that's existing in a fairly hot climate with the standard everything is cold and boiling and scary as shit during the day, and everything is freezing ass fucking cold at night. So
that sounds like a desert.
As discussed, trying to find a mate during these conditions can be rather difficult. Now, I'm imagining a species that either uses the fire kind of in the twilight to try and create enough of a beam of light that things are still warm and hot. It's a lot easier to generate a flame. But they're dark enough that the flame can be seen over distances to basically allow probably a male to try and attract a mate. Or I'm imagining a group of these getting together and in the twilight trying to use it for exactly what Libby was getting at, some type of mating ritual, basically the attempting of peacocking with fire, which I would love to see. Now, generating flame. This is going to have to work a little bit differently, and it's a mechanism we've kind of talked about before. Which is, we have lots of organisms that generate flammable gases. Not usually great for our environment, but eructation, the idea of burping that's seen in cows, generates a large quantity of methane, a super bad greenhouse gas. Now, that type of methane theoretically could be ignited. The biggest problem is it dissipates really quickly. Methane moves out there. So what I'm imagining is a small reptile with basically some type of bladder organism that is carrying out its own form of internal fermentation. It's got a bacterial colony that it's got that's producing methane for it in kind of a sealed off environment, probably anaerobic, so without oxygen, allowing this pocket to build up. It's probably going to be separated off the GI tract, so every once in a while it drops some grass material or vegetation material into this pocket. And the bacteria start eating it, generating the methane that it's going to want to get out of this. Now, when it finds itself in the situation of either trying to attract or trying to impress a female, it's going to be able to release a very small amount of this gas. And as it does, it's going to be able to ignite it. Now, the easiest mechanism, as we've discussed before about igniting this, is going to be the concept of a flint tooth. The idea that you've got a certain mineralized solution that you've made out of your tooth, you can lock it out of place and basically slide it together in order to generate a spark. Theoretically possible, you can generate mineral compositions for various parts of your body in a whole bunch of different inorganic ways. Now, it's not going to be a super impressive fire. I'm hoping that some of them are going to try to generate something a little bit more impressive, but it's going to be a quick burst of flame. Now, in order to do this, because again, it's fucking fire, there's going to have to be mechanisms in place. Thickened skin across the face, it's probably going to have to close its eyes and basically blink when it ignites this fire. And two, I imagine it's going to have a mouth with a large amount of mucus in it to protect itself from secondary burns. It's not going to be able to do this super often. It's going to take a really long time to produce the methane that it's going to use for these displays. And I also imagine this is going to be one of those issues of performance that males of all species struggle with. So skunks are renowned for the fact that young skunks oftentimes actually try to generate the smells that they're going to and totally fail, which means I'm imagining there's going to be a certain amount of desert dancers that are out there that try to light the spark and don't get it in time enough for the methane to dissipate. And then they just kind of have to hang their heads in shame and head back off to the dark, cold rock before they can try again in a couple more days.
Poor desert dancers.
Now, Adam, could we get this to evolve?
I mean, like you're saying, the mineral deposition in your body makes sense. It happens. We've seen it in some animals. A really cool one, I don't know if it's called the magma slug, but basically it is a snail that is adapted to live in the really, really high temperature environments near volcanoes or near hydrothermal events.
Cool.
And it has absorbed iron into its own body, and it basically has these iron scales. I think it's the only animal we've ever seen to generate iron in its own body.
Oh my god, that's cool.
It looks like a fucking Pokemon, I promise you. Look it up. It is so cool looking. But this is an adaptation, so we can maybe have flint-toothed reptiles. I'm not sure what the mechanism would be exactly for that would happen, but we've seen something similar in nature, so sure, that could happen. The signaling with this flame burst, there are weirder things that animals do to get attention from, that male animals do to get attention from female animals, so that also could be selected for and then eventually work. And you could have a really cool case of a runaway selection, which is a case where usually this happens in a sexually selected trait, where this is where a male is doing something and in a choosy female is selecting for a more exaggerated version of this. So moose antlers, deer antlers, the peacock feathers, the bigger they get, the more of a hindrance it is for that male, but the better they look to the female. So there's a trade-off going on there. And I think the trade-off for this species, the desert dancer, is that this flame is obviously dangerous, first and foremost. It could kill them. They could blow up somehow, burn their own face off
100%.
Like a bear in a future episode. Or it is a case where they do this, but it makes them an obvious target for a parasite or a predator species that is adapted to look for that flame and key in on them and nail them immediately.
Ooh.
There are parasitoid wasps that specifically key in on crickets chirping in the night. They're trying to get a mate. Like, oh, cool, there's a cricket over here. Let me go and lay my egg inside of you real quick, which will hatch and eat you from the inside. Thank you for telling me where you are. So the desert dancer is going to be suffering from the same problem, I think.
Ooh.
But not outside the realm of possibility, I think. Just very unlikely.
Now, Libby, my little fire-breathing, peacocking, try-to-impress-a-girl reptile. Any chance I could get him a movie role?
Absolutely. I'm thinking, so correct me if I'm wrong, both of you, but a lot of desert species have to be fairly agile and quick, correct? Because you have like a lot of open ground that you're trying to like escape from. Like, I know I'm thinking
they can be.
Yeah.
Desert hare.
The smaller ones are.
Yeah. Certain reptiles.
Yeah. Yep. So I'm kind of imagining this thing is pretty nimble. And while the fire might not do much damage, it certainly is an animal, sharp teeth, that kind of thing. So what I'm thinking is Burning Man happens. It sees all these flames going off from all those little, like,
from the actual fire dancers.
Yeah, from the actual fire dancers.
AKA crunchy women you want to stay away from.
It gets confused. And then you have a bunch of, you know, teens and young adults on drugs and all What was the word that I discovered today?
Zootered.
Zootered up.
So you're imagining a piranha on land, and instead of dropping the motorboat into it, you're imagining Vin Rames walking along with a fan that he's just disconnected the protective metal railing from the outside, and he's holding that thing up as he walks along trying to hit the reptiles.
But maybe there's a bunch of them, just like the piranhas. Like, they all see this fire, and because it's so hard to find a mate in the desert, they're just, like, zoning in on it.
I love the concept of the orgy tent burning down at Burning Man, so...
I mean, you have males that will have, like, that will go into rut, and they fight each other, so while this is not the most aggressive damage-dealing adaptation, I imagine a case where you have what's called a lek, which is where males do a little performative dances. Prairie hens do this, and I'm not sure if they do it in groups or if it's just one male that sets up his own little lek and then dances around trying to show off his big, impressive chest pouches. But I'm imagining a case where these desert dancers are getting, all the males are getting into a group, doing their fire, and then whoever has the best fire wins, and all the other males slink away in shame, and the females are like, this guy has the best fire.
I like it.
This guy is fire.
This guy's
fire.
So they
see this, and they're like, oh, there's a lek going on over there. I gotta get over there and try to get a female.
Yep.
So they all swarm Burning Man, and chaos ensues.
Hey, Haley, guess where I'm taking you this weekend?
Burning Man!
It's this awesome celebration where they burn this huge wooden man. It's all about life, love, and the power of community.
No, it's all about a bunch of naked morons drinking and doing lots of drugs. What are we, 12?
Wait, before you decide, this is a microcosm of the power that is Burning Man. Imagine this, but 70 feet tall.
Now, the last organism that I've been playing around with, which, Libby, what was the better name you came up for this?
The Hot Houdini.
Ooh. I mean, that does sound like a sex move that involves abandoning your partner halfway through, but yes.
Absolutely.
The Jungle Blazing Frog, or the Hot Houdini. Now, this species I wanted to play with a slightly different mechanism for. So, when things bite you and try to eat you, you want to get away from those things. And we've seen all kinds of cool evolutionary mechanisms. As we discussed, octopus, Bardia beetle, there is that species of trap jaw ant that we've talked about before, which literally has a trap jaw so that it can point it at the ground and activate it so it can get the fuck out of there when something tries to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fire is terrifying and bright and scary. So, the species that I'm envisioning is some type of amphibian species that's spending a certain amount of its time, like, obviously on land and in the water, and it's going to be wet, moist most of the time. And when it gets bit or attacked, it's going to need a unique mechanism to try and defend itself. Now, the advantage is it's going to be wet already, and likely it's going to have some type of mucus layer. We know that that can serve as a really good mechanism for protecting yourself against fire. And what I'm imagining, instead of actually generating a true flame, is kind of a mechanism similar to what Adam was discussing earlier. The flashbang grenade, a mechanism that's loved by every gamer everywhere at all times, basically consists of a certain type of metal-oxygen mixture of magnesium and aluminum, as well as a oxidizing compound, something like potassium percolate or perchlorate or potassium nitrate. Basically, the two compounds are mixed, so they're kept in different sections of the grenade. And when the two compounds mix, they generate an exothermic reaction where there is a large amount of heat generated, which is what produces that blinding flash associated. Now, I'm wondering if we could have a species similar to the skunk or the Bombardier beetle. It basically has two different compounds, or similar to Adam's dragonflies. You have two different compounds that are separate, and you can mix them externally, and they have a very quick exothermic reaction. Can you generate a blinding flash? Can this frog basically... Now, it's not going to be breathing this out, wrong end. It's definitely going to be coming out of the backside. If it's running away or it's already bit, is it going to be able to release a very small amount of these compounds that it's isolated from its diet that are basically going to react in the outside world and not generate a fire, but just generate a blinding flash of light? Something that'll cause the predator to let go of it or stop chasing it. Now, the biggest mechanism that I struggled with this, and I think is going to be the limitation, I have no idea how fast you can get these compounds to react. Obviously, in a mechanical sense, we can release these two compounds in such a way that the flashbang goes off immediately. I don't know if a species would be able to release these in such a way that they would basically activate right away. That's release these chemicals that immediately blinds its prey. But if it could, and basically kept them, it's going to then be protected from the heat that's going to be generated by the mucus in the water, and it's going to be in a much better position to get the fuck out of there. Now, does this make sense?
I think that in theory, it makes sense. You have organisms that have these kind of nasty adaptations to try to get away from other organisms, speaking of frogs in general. If you've ever gone trying to catch frogs when you were a kid, you know that as soon as you pick them up, they pee on you. So that's just one of those things where they have some mechanism in place to try to deter a predator from consuming them just by some kind of foul tasting or smelling fluid. But there's another group of somewhat closely related organisms, the Strophurus geckos, which are a group of lizards from Australia, also called phasmid geckos, spiny-tailed geckos, or striped geckos. If you've ever seen the video of the gecko spraying fluid from little spots on its tail, that's what these guys like to do, guys and gals. Basically, if a bird tries to consume them, they spray a harmless, so not quite the same as the hot Houdini, but a very foul-smelling and not-so-nice fluid from their tail on would-be predators to then distract or dissuade them from trying to eat the geckos themselves. So maybe the hot Houdini has some kind of similar mechanism where it can spray out this nasty chemical. And another thing that these geckos have is a very, very bright blue mouth they open wide whenever they're trying to spray this fluid at their predators, which blue is a very uncommon color in nature. Not very many animals have it.
Huh.
So it's a very alarming and somewhat surprising thing to see. There's a lizard that just straight up has a blue mouth and it just opens it wide whenever a predator gets close. Because it's like, Jesus, what the fuck? And maybe the predator just goes away because it's kind of freaked out. But the hot Houdini, maybe it doesn't spray fire, but maybe there's some kind of patch on its back that it can open or reveal that is a bright, vivid red to then give you that flame appearance as it's spraying you with this caustic and nasty fluid.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I'm envisioning is basically it's going to get a name associated with fire, not from its breathing fire, but from any local groups that witness it are going to see a big flash of light and simply assume, oh, it's breathing fire.
Yeah.
Now, could this evolve?
I mean, we have it evolving in the bombardier beetle. So if the physiological mechanisms can get in place and that there is a way for an amphibian to have this kind of violent chemical reaction that an arthropod has, arthropods being the insects in this case, the beetles, potentially, but I don't find it very likely. The amphibians many of them have to breathe through their skin because they don't have developed lungs. So any kind of chemical reaction like this is going to run the risk of drying you out or damaging your skin or burning you. So I think that would be very, very heavily selected against.
Now, Libby, my terrifying flashbang frogs, can they sign up? Do they have a role in a Zack Snyder film?
I mean, to me, having an animal that's just trying to get away all the time doesn't scream monster movie. I'm thinking more of it like my octopus teacher, like sweet documentary about this researcher going into the jungle and befriending this very shy flashbang frog.
So the researcher is going to be blind at the end of your film is the way you're going to be envisioning this.
Yeah. Probably. Yes, but he has a friend. Like, that's the lesson.
Nice.
And he won an Academy Award.
Okay.
And he also abandoned his family for this octopus. If you've watched the movie, Libby and I had a very good time seeing how dedicated this man was to his octopus friend, seemingly at the cost of his own relationship with his family. This was very much our interpretation of this movie. There was not any kind of subtext in the movie. But the sheer amount of time this man had to spend with that octopus day in, day out for like a year
plus.
I don't know how his relationship with his family did not suffer. Great movie, though. Check it out.
Side note.
I do recommend. I'm just giving that guy shit.
I had to have a radical change in my life. And the only way I knew to do it was to be in this ocean with her. And then I had this crazy idea. What happens if I just went every day?
So that's it. That's what I've got. My creatures are not going to be terrifying, winged, breathing fire down on the unexpected population. Fighting what were the terrible monsters called from Game of Thrones?
White Walkers.
Oh, the White Walkers.
I don't imagine my hot Houdini being super used as Jon Snow whips one of these into the crowd. I don't imagine it being super impressive.
Does I have a question. Does the Snowpiercer have fur then?
Yeah, it's gonna
it would have to
survive those types of climates, which it's gonna be a little bit of a fire hazard. Their fur doesn't tend to react, and it's not like Arctic air isn't super dry all the time, so that's a great point.
Well, could it have like more seal skin or like that kind of fur?
If it was fully aquatic, it could. It's just a shit ton of blubber, but if this is going to be behaving like a polar bear, it needs to have fur that could dry out and then keep a lot of heat inside of it. And like a polar bear, I would expect it to be white to trap as much heat, as thermal energy as possible from the sun.
Well, in defensive camouflage, right?
That too.
I'm imagining for some reason there's a Futurama quote involving trying to set a polar bear on fire, and I'm definitely finding it for a clip later.
There has to be. That just makes too much sense.
You can't keep me here forever. Sooner or later, a polar bear will happen by. A nice, flammable polar bear.
Polar bears don't burn! I've tried many times!
But yeah, those are my mechanisms for my realistic dragons and fire-breathing creatures.
I like them.
And that's kind of all I got.
I like it too. I think the really cool thing is, besides the flashbang frog, which is a wonderful creature, and aka the hot Houdini, I think that there is, for the other two creatures, your Desert Dancer and your Snowpiercer, there is somewhat of a parallel available in nature already for these kinds of mechanisms. Although they are different, and just because we haven't seen it evolve before doesn't mean that it could not evolve. It's just a matter of the right mutation arising at the right time in the right environment. So, maybe. But we can potentially hope for dragons in the real world.
In a couple million years.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we've reached the end of our little insert episode. Thank you guys for bearing with us as we step a little out of order with what we wanted.
Actually, I was going to say, if you have your own dragon ideas, please feel free to email us. We can maybe reference them in future episodes.
So.
We would love to read out your dragon ideas and for the kind of maybe habitat it lives in, what mechanisms it has.
And then Adam and Sam can eviscerate them ecologically.
I will eviscerate it with a shit sandwich or a compliment sandwich, you know.
There you go.
Say something nice, cutting criticism. Say something else really nice.
As long as there's nice stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. But next week we'll be coming back with The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing. So the first remake of this story. Is there anybody out there? Whatever that book's called. Basically, amazing movie. We're all real excited to talk about it, and that'll be next week. And as we say here at the end of every episode of Cinematica and Amelia, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
And the dragons could be.
Ooh.
Bye.